He is Robin Leach. He is Jada Markin. This is Car Keys.
It is, and we have been going through a spate of funny sort of weather patterns, and what has been noted by me watching nightly news is the extreme numbers of what appear to be stupid crash scenes on interstates out in the Midwest, Texas, or wherever the ice is, with tractor trailers shown careening into other vehicles on the interstates as if they were going along at 70 miles an hour and had no clue that they had no traction.
Yep.
To that point, I'm not sure what Jay's Holiday on Ice is all about, but
I'm ready to barge in.
Yeah. I mean, it's a good movie, but go ahead.
Why aren't the highways being closed down by the states before they even let these trucks and other vehicles go rolling down the road? They must have enough information about weather patterns to know that they should just close the highways down, and like they do occasionally in the Northeast, and just say nobody goes on the highways between 8 o'clock in the evening and 6 o'clock in the morning or something.
But I have a little take on that.
Okay. Please do.
And I agree with you. It frustrates me tremendously, and I get really angry when I see these huge pileups,
right.
Most of which are avoidable. To your point about not getting on the highways if the weather conditions are known to become really bad. With tractor trailers, there is an issue. Having traveled the country back and forth, east to west, and north-south, is where you put them all. The rest areas are jam-packed. There really is not a lot of, really physically, a lot of spots to park all those tractor trailers.
Right.
Having said that, I think one of the major problems is those vehicles are very heavy and, in a sense, are do better in the snow up to a point. So I found myself, for instance, on the Mass Pike a couple of years ago at 40 miles an hour, struggling to stay on the road and being passed by tractor trailers and buses going 60 miles an hour. And they seemingly had no problems doing that. And that's fine up and until, so you have a speed differential already between cars and trucks where, trucks are actually driving faster than cars. The problem is when you lose grip, there's just nothing holding you back, and you see those trucks just plow into. They have nowhere to go.
Right.
If not taking them off the road, you really have to slow them down, and that's the bottom line. And obviously, if you can stay off the roads, you should be off the roads. It is very uncomfortable being in a car surrounded by tractor trailers in a snowstorm on the highways. And it can end very badly.
Right.
Yeah, and what was really interesting, in my view, this is not ice-related, but it is crash-related, is the disconnect, because, one of the reasons to watch races are for their fiery crashes.
Yes.
Speaking of
we saw a few yesterday.
That's what I was,
sure did.
Apropos. And so then, you don't take that out and go, you don't take that out of your driveway with you, unfortunately.
Well, and there's two ways, coming from the racing world, And having coached drivers at starts of races, for instance, and I'm going to be careful in what I say. If a line of traffic, whether on the racetrack or on the highway, is moving tight, close together, if you do impact the car in front of you, if you're only a few inches away, that bump is going to be very light. If you impact a car that's going substantially slower than you are and coming from a great distance, that impact is going to be very, very harsh, right? In racing, ironically, oftentimes you're much better being very, very, very close to the car in front of you. Is that what we should be doing on the highway? Absolutely not. So, correct. No, don't take the Daytona 500 principles and go apply them on the highway.
Well, that first crash of the Daytona 500 was really a sight to watch rerun several times. And, of course, with the technology, they had to slow the whole thing down for replays, and you could see almost inch by inch the thing developing as it developed in the big crash yesterday. You know, what a pack of cars going at 190 to 200 miles an hour, all sort of in unison. And,
yeah.
And it took just a slight tap, and they were talking about it, as Jay, as you know, where the tap occurs to make all the difference in survivability and or disaster.
Yeah.
And once you get the tap and once the car gets, a car that gets tapped gets thrown out of
line.
Yeah. It's just a matter of watching that thing unfold. Did the race ever finish, Jay?
Yes.
I was in bed, but I watched the results in the morning, and there was a crash on the last lap again. And to that point, if I can say something. So we're talking about the Daytona 500, right?
Yes.
It was the anniversary of the 20th anniversary of Dale Earnhardt's death. And we've come a really, really long way in track safety and in car safety, both on racetracks and in passenger cars. Had Dale Earnhardt been in a similar crash this year or even a few years ago, he most likely would have survived the impact. And again, one of the major differences in the design of racetracks is these soft barriers that you have all around the track. So if you look at the wall around the Daytona, or any super speedway for that matter, they now have a soft barrier all around that is mounted on mounts that can compress that are maybe 8 to 12 inches from the wall itself. And absorbing energy is all about surviving a crash.
Right.
And that applies on the roads, on the public highways as well, of course.
Well, you remember the Fitch barrier that was developed.
Yeah, it's exactly that principle.
What that does to absorb the impact and absorb a crash situation occurring, and how they laid those barrels out in design and layout so that cars would survive the crash if you ran into a Fitch barrier.
Yep.
And it's spread across the racing world, as you say, the soft barriers that they're putting around before you hit the wall, so that maybe there's a chance that you can actually finish a race as opposed to go to the pits.
So while we're talking about crashes and safety, let's get our tidbit information, safety tip of the day, right away.
Okay.
We're going into the chances of a major ice storm.
Right.
And we all know, driving in the snow can be fun and one thing, and you can control cars. Driving on ice is just a totally other game altogether. And there's no good outcome when you start sliding on ice.
And I've said it before, four-wheel drive,
if you have any doubts,
not be better than two-wheel drive on ice. And it may allow you to go forward better, but it certainly doesn't increase the chances of stopping better. Anti-lock braking notwithstanding, it's just amazing how little control you have once you go into a slide on an icy road surface. And especially if you enter curves too quickly, and it can be as simple as coming down a hill to a driveway, which occurred at my house in Sharon over the weekend. My driveway had not been plowed. It had been plowed, but it hadn't really been plowed. So, and we turned into the driveway, and it was very interesting how the centrifugal force took over, because we obviously came down the hill on a town road that was perfectly clear. And then we turned onto a snow-packed driveway, and the front end of the Jeep lost traction and drifted off the driveway outline and hit a slight side hill slide and ended up pancaked on snow underneath the Jeep with not enough tire contact to the ground so that we could back up and get out of the driveway. And we left the Jeep in this location in the field overnight, and I had to snow blow the field and dig the snow out to get the Jeep back onto terra firma so that I could make it back onto the driveway.
So what I just want to spend a second on, guys, is the, you know, Robin, you have driven all your life. Jay, you've driven all your life. We've got a lot of people out here who don't have the vaguest idea. You know, first and foremost, when you start slipping, most people, myself included, you know, you certainly go into an altered state. So
the first thing you want to, you know, our first reflex is to hit the brakes. And nowadays with ABS and traction control, that may be okay, but it's still the number one thing you want to do is steer the car, and you really have to look ahead and find a clear path and just try to steer the car
gently
where there's open space. And I'll be very honest with you, I've done this in the past or been ready to do that. Ended up on a country road where there was no salt, no sand. You know, the road was a sheet of ice, but being lucky enough that there was snow on the ground and therefore snow banks on the side, if you're going 5 or 10 miles an hour and that car is just sliding on ice and picking up speed, you're way better letting the car go in a snow bank because you're better going off in a snow bank like you did in your driveway at 5 miles an hour than hitting something a lot harder once the vehicle picks up more speed.
Correct. Absolutely right, Jay.
But I always say, don't be afraid to get out of the car, step, and check the road surfaces. You know, if you're slipping, walking on the road, you shouldn't be driving on it.
Well, to your comment starting this segment of the show, the weather pattern is for extremely potential icing conditions on the roads. And, of course, our roads, when they're dry, you can see they're dry, but when they're wet, you cannot see necessarily whether they're wet and frozen or just plain wet.
Yep.
And also, one sense that things are going downhill in terms of condition would be if the rain is on your windshield and it starts to freeze up and the defroster is not able to keep it thawed out. If it's freezing up on your windshield at 30 miles an hour, you better be slowing down, and you better be watching the road surfaces right away as an indication that maybe the road surfaces are already frozen into potentially dangerous conditions.
And so, again, moving on. Interesting news coming out in the political world, I think, with the a bill about to be proposed in Congress about extending or renewing tax credits for electric cars. And I don't know if any one of you saw that or read about that, but the proposed bill is to allow a $7,000 tax credit to buyers of cars. And I think they have to be, what I saw was U.S. cars, so I'm guessing they have to be made in the U.S. or I'm not exactly sure. But a $7,000 credit to, it would basically apply to, I believe, Chevy, GM, Ford, and Tesla, and extending to past the 200,000 car mark that was the initial tax credit, and extending all the way up to 600,000 cars, meaning the first 600,000 cars being produced by this manufacturer would allow buyers to get a $7,000 tax credit. That's huge in 2021, in my opinion. And we're going to see people like myself rushing out and doing math again, looking at Teslas, looking at Volkswagen ID4s. Again, I don't know if the Volkswagen will qualify or not. Look at Chevy Bolt EV and the new EUV. So Chevy and their Bolt sub-brand are coming out with two new vehicles, an updated Bolt EV this summer, as well as a compact SUV. And it should be interesting to see. It should, it certainly should be a good incentive to steer more people into purchasing electric cars.
And when is it up for discussion/investigations?
I don't know. It seems like it's a done deal in some ways. One of the manufacturers already had it incorporated in their, you know, how they put the pricing on. Tesla does that, and they go, they have a little asterisk, and they say $5,000. You know, they put the price that includes a $5,000 gas saving potential, which is ridiculous. And one of the manufacturers, I think it was GM, was putting in the potential $7,000 tax credit into their price computation on
their
website.
Well, we've talked about this electric car alternative in terms of the extreme amount of savings an electric car owner will have during the life of an ownership of an electric car. Yes, no gas pricing. I do not know whether there's a national average of what it costs to recharge an electric car battery overnight, whether it's $5 or $8 or what, but I can tell you it's less than gasoline. And the other thing, Jay, you've mentioned several times about the electric cars, the whole maintenance situation has been turned upside down with electric cars. There is no maintenance to speak of at a lot of levels in electric cars.
That's correct.
That you don't even need to have a $5,000 or $7,000 credit to make that an interesting situation. The biggest issue I think that we've dealt with on this electric car, this transition to electric car interest, has been people's concern about range anxiety, and I think it's evaporating into the mist because they're all pretty much getting 300 miles or capable of getting 300 miles. The Bolt's, what, 236 or 250 now.
But, yeah.
And people who are enjoying these smaller cars with a little bit lower range are finding it's really not an issue as long as they remember to check the charge level at the end of each day of driving these vehicles.
Well, I'm going to say, Robin, it sounds like you're coming around.
Yeah, I know.
That's what I'm going to say.
Well, Jay and I have talked about it. Jay thought he might get a Bolt at one point. I drove a Bolt, 3 years ago? Jay drove a Bolt 3 years ago, and we both came away really rather intrigued by the thing. And, it is a perfectly nice vehicle.
And to that point, in this bill, there would be a provision for something like a $2,500 tax credit for used electric cars that are 2 or 2.5 years or older. So the first Chevy Bolts would qualify for that $2,500 credit, which would be limited to, there would be an income cap on that credit for, I don't know what reason they would cap the more affordable option, if you will. I've looked online. I've looked at Auto Trader this morning. You can find Chevy Bolts, 2017s for $12,000, $13,000, with 30,000, 40,000 miles. So, basically, you can get into an electric car for around $10,000, $11,000. That's pretty good. That's a pretty good deal.
What I want to ask, though, we've got about 5 minutes left. What I want to ask, Jay, is how does one find out whether or when this kicks, when this kicks in.
I didn't forget the question. I don't know, and I don't know that that's very clearly spelled out, because one of the articles I read about it was bringing up the question as to whether people who bought electric cars in the first quarter of 2021, before the bill would be signed, if they would in fact be eligible for that credit. And I think that is still, there seems to be a yes answer to that, but it's not definite. And again, that bill has just been proposed, and I don't know much about it, and I don't know how long it will linger around in Congress.
More important to be aware that such a thing is happening, or
I don't know whether this is an overblown discussion topic, because I don't really know whether the people are actually buying cars on the basis of potential tax credits.
Well, people who have, hold on, let me just barge in right away. $7,000 is $7,000 to a lot of people. And maybe people who might have been buying a $100,000 electric car, it may not have mattered that much. But people who are the next wave of people getting into this market, maybe the people were looking at $30,000-$40,000 cars. And guess what? $7,000 does matter.
It really does. And I think that that's an important distinction to make. If you want to move on to any other topics, again, we've got 4 minutes.
Okay, I do. I am looking at the Comparo test of the Raptor versus the 2021 Ram 1500 TRX. And talk about ludicrous features in these vehicles. These are pickup trucks. We've discussed them briefly. They're $73,000 to $90,000 to buy, and got ludicrous amounts of power in the engines. Can do all sorts of gymnastics that regular pickup trucks can't do or shouldn't do, I suppose. They might be able to do it. And the Ram TRX won the Comparo test in this particular magazine over the Ford Raptor. But it also ended up costing like $16,000 more than the Ford Raptor. And I don't know how many of these are going to be sold. Ford Raptors are pretty well sold out generally. I mean, I'm sure there's going to be Ram TRX is going to be a very popular vehicle. I mean, the mileage, you don't get any mileage in the gasoline department. Talk about gasoline costs with either of these trucks. But that's ludicrous. Then I'm looking at another magazine where the Bugatti Chiron Sport costs $3.3 million. Makes 1,479 horsepower, and it's the quickest car that the car driver has ever tested. It's not affordable by any means for more mere mortals, and I don't know how many they'll make. They'll probably sell every one, but who needs it?
Wait till the 1,100 horsepower Tesla comes out next year, and it's for sale right now on their website for $139,000.
A rare, absolute bargain compared to the Bugatti Chiron Sport.
Total bargain.
Yeah. I mean, you could, so be it. So that's all I have to say. And, Jay, you could finish on whatever you'd like.
Do we have time, Jill?
We've got 3 minutes, 2 minutes.
So one of the other industry, a little tidbit. Did you guys know that both Cadillac and Lincoln were founded by the same person?
Nope. Had no clue.
I believe an engineer by the name of Henry Leland, guy from Vermont, and he sold the Cadillac company that he co-founded to Henry Ford's first partners, and they rebranded the company Cadillac, and that was eventually sold to GM. And Mr. Leland went on to create the Lincoln Motor Company that went on to become insolvent in the early 1920s, and that was in turn bought by Henry Ford.
What a fascinating piece of trivia.
There we go.
I would call it history. He is Robin Leach. He is Jay DeMarkin. This is Car Keys. Baby, you can drive my-